Thank you. I'm actually rather surprised to see so many people back. Last time I was here actually has a connection to this time. I had arranged to do a series of talks for the program, and I did my Friday night talks. I don't even remember what the topic was supposed to be, but I couldn't sleep on Friday night, and an entire two talks just sort of wrote themselves in my head. So I got up and about 4 in the morning or so, prepared a whole new set of PowerPoints and gave them. And the connection between that and this is that was the first time I talked about critical theory. I didn't call it that, but that was the first time I did it. And actually, if any of you were there, you're going to be seeing a few things that are going to look a little bit familiar. Because, well, the basic points that I wanted to make at that point, that the way that the thing emerged in my head still applies. And I think it's still a really important way of understanding what critical theory is about. Now, along with that, I think it would be important at this point to review a few of the key ideas from last night. There was a lot of philosophy in there, a lot of history. But here are some of the bottom line things that you really need to grasp. First of all, as Dick pointed out, this is a lot of egghead philosophy stuff, but it has a massive impact on our culture today. And so, you know, Thucydides once said, an ancient Greek historian said, you may not be interested in politics, but politics is interested in you. Mm-hmm. Same thing is true for philosophy. So it's important to understand at least the basics of the ideas we talked about last night. Key points here. First of all, it's all about power. Power in postmodernism and in critical theory is the only reality. It is all about power. Secondly, we had the idea of intersectionality. The idea that you are oppressed and frankly your identity comes from the intersection of a whole bunch of categories that they define as being important. And that list of defined categories is constantly increasing. You can be an oppressor in one and oppressed in another. And the degree of oppression that you experience basically is, well, how many of these categories you fit into. That's important because, well, we'll get into why that's important. They're the component of that in a minute. So intersectionality is there. And then the other thing is standpoint theory, which says that everything you know, everything you think is true, every word you say is spoken from a particular standpoint, which is created by your intersectional identity. So all of these different categories that you fall into shape how you think, shape how you behave, shape everything about you. You're not really an individual. What you are is the product of all of these categories and where you fit into them. Okay, so those are a handful of the key ideas I want you to keep in mind. And with that, we'll move on to the other key idea that will hopefully help make sense of why things are going the way they're going. And come on. Well, all right, we'll do it this way, do it the old-fashioned way. That is the idea of the zero-sum game. A zero-sum game is a term that refers to, technology hates me. Okay. A zero-sum game is a game in which, in order to win, you have to make someone else lose. In order to advance, you have to push somebody else down. That's the way a zero-sum game works. Now, most often when we talk about zero-sum games in the culture, it's the economy. So the idea is, if you think back to Occupy Wall Street, the 1%, the idea was, if someone has a big piece of the pie, there isn't much left for everybody else, and everybody else gets a smaller piece of the pie. The problem with this is, well, I spoke to someone last night who's an economics professor, and I'm sure he would tell you just as well as I can that the problem with this is we've got bakeries. There's not just one pie. We have the possibility of making more pies. It's not so simple as that everything is just this fixed sum, and so if somebody gets a bigger piece, someone else gets a smaller piece. It's just simply bad economics. But it turns out that in postmodernism, yes, it does work, it goes way beyond economics. Everything in this form of postmodernism, everything in critical theory is a zero-sum game. Now, economics falls into this, as we said, with the Occupy Wall Street movement, but power, to bottom line it, power is also a zero-sum game. If someone has power, the only way they got it was taking it from someone else. So race. White people have power because they have taken it away from people of color. That is the only way that white people gain power. Sex. Men dominate society because they've taken power away from women. Class. Well, same thing. You're in a higher class, you're in a lower class, whatever, because some people are oppressing others. We can add to this, if you think back to Michel Foucault, who talked about sexuality as being a power game as well. He argued that, you know, the sort of straight marriage thing, you know, your husband and wife with kids, and that's the proper way to regulate sexuality. He argued that that was a tool of oppression for LGBT people. So the traditional household is the fact that it is given a privileged position in society. That happens because they are taking power away from LGBT, and so on. Everything is a zero-sum game. And the key here to understand why this is important is the last one. Moral authority is also a zero-sum game. And what that means is, well, the one thing that is really considered a sin in critical theory is oppression. That is the only sin in critical theory. So if you are an oppressor, you are a sinner, and therefore you lose moral authority. But since moral authority is a zero-sum game, when you lose it, the person you are oppressing gains it. Thus, being a victim gives you moral authority. And the more categories of oppression you are under, the more moral authority you have. If you don't get anything else out of this weekend, remember that. Because that is the thing that makes the whole system run. That's fundamentally the worldview we are dealing with. So, your identity is defined by your various intersectional categories. You lose moral authority from oppressor categories. You gain moral authority from oppressed categories. And the more oppressed categories you have, the more moral authority you have. Okay? Now, again, as I said before, oppression is really the only sin in critical theory. So let's ask the question, if we are sinners, what do we need? Well, obviously the answer is salvation. So the question is, how do you get salvation? The only way to get salvation is repentance. You have to reject your privilege, because privilege equals oppression. You have to reject your privilege. You have to accept by faith the entire doctrinal system that I've been outlining and become woke. You can also, sometimes they refer to this as being an ally. That's particularly with LGBT stuff. That is the only route to salvation. Now, some versions of critical theory say you can't do this. In some versions of critical race theory is pretty complicated, but in some versions of critical race theory, you can never escape your whiteness if you're white. You're toast, your history. You can't do anything about it. And there are a number of books that are quite popular, White Fragility, for example, that basically makes this argument. It's impossible for you to escape it. There is no salvation for you. The best you can do is live a life of constant repentance and hope that in the end, God will accept you. Except they don't really talk about God. Okay. Now, I'm putting this in terms that are, well, I mean, I'm obviously Christianizing the language here, but you need to understand, we are dealing with a religion. It's a religion without God, but it's a religion nonetheless. Like I said, this is the thing, if you get the zero-sum game and you keep it in mind, you will be able to make sense of most of what is going on. This is really the critical idea. Okay, so the goal then, remember, what you want to do is get all of the various oppressed groups allied together to overturn the hegemony. We're going all the way back to the New Left here. The goal in critical theory is to create communities of virtuous victimhood.
Virtuous victimhood.
The idea is, well, here's a brief list that I put together. Women are victims of male oppression. LGBTQ+, they're victims of heteronormative oppression. People of color are victims of white oppression. Muslims are victims of Western oppression. Pagans are victims of Christian oppression. Undocumented workers are victims of American oppression. The poor are victims of corporate oppression. And the planet is victims of industrial oppression. Make no mistake, hard green policy falls under the umbrella of critical theory. Because the globe, the physical world, the environment is a victim. And thus, as a victim, it has moral authority and a claim on us to do whatever it takes to protect it, preserve it, and so on. Up to the point where a few years ago, there were a number of people meeting in Texas who were talking about how good it would be if a massive number of people around the world died of some deadly disease. Ebola was a good option for this, according to the people in this conference. Because you see, well, there are simply too many of us. And in order to protect the environment, in order to advance the cause of the victim, we need to, well, do whatever it takes. So even environmentalism, in its radical form, can fall under this umbrella of critical theory. Now, if you look over this list, there are a number of things in here that don't seem to make a lot of sense. How do you combine feminism with a pro-Islamic stance when women can't drive in Saudi Arabia? How do you combine LGBTQ+ with Islam when they stone gays? How do you do this? Well, it doesn't make logical sense, but the system is not logical. And it is intentionally and proudly illogical. Because logic, you see, well, who's the guy who came up with the rules of logic that we use? This guy named Aristotle. He's an old white guy. The point is that what all of these groups have in common is the experience of oppression. And one of the buzz phrases that's connected with the idea of intersectionality is that all oppression is connected. All oppression is the same. Every one of these groups here, by virtue of the fact that they are defined as an oppressed category, has moral authority. They have virtue. and thus they have common interests, even when in practice this can create massive contradictions. A good example of this, and by the way, this is a hint about where the future of postmodernism and critical theory. A good example of this is a group of people known as TERFs, T-E-R-F. It stands for Trans-Exclusionary Radical Feminists. These are radical feminists who actually believe that being a woman is a biological issue, not a mental issue. And so they do not accept the idea of trans women. They argue that to have a trans woman, you know, to treat that as the same as a biological woman is frankly an insult to the experience of women in the real world. And the net result is what we're finding is trans women, quote unquote, are taking athletic records in a variety of different places, are named female athlete of the month or the year or whatever, and so on. And these TERFs, trans-exclusionary radical feminists, are furious over it. For good reason. What you're seeing, now, by the way, the result of this is when someone, a very prominent advocate of the, you know, these kinds of progressive causes, like J.K. Rowling, the author of the Harry Potter books, when she comes out against this whole idea of trans stuff, there was actually a serious attempt to cancel her. Sooner or later, critical theory, like most revolutionary movements, is going to turn on itself and it's going to begin to consume its own young. We're already seeing this happening, most prominently in this issue of TERF. But the internal contradictions in the system are going to get to the point where it's going to collapse. Okay, that's just, I'll just tell you that ahead of time. But in any event, this whole system that we have here, like I said, it may not make logical sense, but the common ground on all of these things is their idea that these are oppressed groups who have had power unjustly taken away from them, and therefore they are virtuous. That's the core idea. They have moral authority. And the more of these groups you're in, again, the more moral authority you have. Now, we're going to see this playing out in a variety of different ways. But let's start with, I'm going to put my focus on two areas here because I think they're the two biggest ones we need to deal with. Critical race theory and LGBTQ issues. Okay, now critical race theory. By way of background, critical race theory began in a field called critical legal studies. It started off really in law schools. And as such, it doesn't share fully in the critical theory pedigree that I just described last night. It actually comes, we get it coming in from a bit of a different direction. The key figure who starts it is Derrick Bell. Derrick Bell was a professor of law at, I believe it's Harvard. And Derrick Bell argued that American law, by its very nature, is white supremacist. American law, the entire system of American law and American justice, is intentionally designed to keep whites in power and to keep blacks under their thumb. This kind of thinking is what informed the 1619 Project, for those of you who are familiar with that. Okay. The 1619 Project, for those of you who aren't, said that America was actually founded in 1619, not 1776, because 1619 was the time when the first slaves came here. And so America is, by its essence, in its origin and everything else, a slaveholding society, a racist society. This is baked into American culture. Okay. Now, Bell didn't go there, but what he did, but that's an outgrowth of Bell's idea. Bell's idea is that the American system, American law, and everything else is, in fact, fundamentally, at its core, racist. He further argued that, you know, if you look at my lifetime, racism was far worse when I was a kid than it is now. So you could look at this and say, but Professor Bell, we've made progress. Bell's response is that any progress that has been made on civil rights for blacks came because it benefited whites. It was not really about blacks. Now, that may sound completely off the wall, but consider this. This is fact. They uncovered recently State Department documents that basically said that with all of the racial unrest in the 1960s, it was hurting America's reputation abroad. It was hurting our relations with our allies and so on. And thus, we need to do something about the racial unrest. So, according to Bell, what this does, this is the smoking gun that points to the fact that the Civil Rights Act and things like that were passed only to advance white America's causes overseas. So Bell is the one who starts this. And again, his focus is specifically on law. This is then picked up by Kimberly Crenshaw. Bell is bottom right. Kimberly Crenshaw is above him. Crenshaw is going to develop Bell's ideas further. I'm not going to go into her in a lot of detail. I will just tell you that she is the one who develops the idea of intersectionality that we talked about last night. And it's originally done, again, in this context of emerging critical race theory. Now, there are other people we can point to as well. There's black liberation theology, things like that, that are also going to be influences here. But if you look up the history of critical race theory, these are the people you're going to see first and foremost. Now, again, identity, it's neither individual nor universal, you know, what it means to be human, and it's the intersection of categories. All of these things are the work of Crenshaw. Okay, so now, critical legal theory, critical race theory had stayed under the umbrella of critical legal theory, it wouldn't have the kind of impact that it has had in the country. But people took the idea of critical race theory from critical legal theory and ran with it. They used it in the context of the cultural Marxism and postmodernism that we talked about last time. And what emerges out of that is going to be something considerably more complex and far-reaching than Derrick Bell had in mind when he developed the idea in the first place. First of all, let's get some of the core pillars of critical race theory out here. First of all, race is a social construct. What does that mean? It means, actually, quite correctly, it means that race is not biological. The biological distinctions between races are essentially non-existent. Think about it like this. Pick a characteristic that you would use to define race. Let's say skin color. When I was in Belgium, in the Flanders area, you will find people in Belgium that have skin that is close to paper white. If you go to places in Africa or India or some other places, you will find people whose skin is effectively coal black. You will also find every gradation of skin color and variation between the two of them. In other words, skin color exists on a spectrum, from paper white to coal black, everything in between with variant shades and things like that. Where do you draw the line? How do you determine who is black and who is white? I know people who are of African descent who have skin that is lighter than people I know who come from the Mediterranean basin. So skin color makes a really poor marker for race. Hair color, same deal. Hair texture, same deal. And so on. Race is, in fact, a social construct. If you'd like, sooner or later during the course of this, I will give you an explanation of where our ideas of race come from. But there is no formal way of defining race in terms of biology. You can't do it. And in fact, the word race has changed its meaning over the centuries. If you go back to, say, early 17th century, 17th century, late 16th century, somewhere in that period, you're going to find race used frequently as a synonym for nationality. I found documents that talked about the British race being distinct from the French, German, or Italian races. So the original meaning of the word was essentially nationality. It changes meaning really in a more or less systematic way in the 19th century. And it largely changes its meaning because of slavery. Slavery in the early modern period within the Western world, America, Britain, and so on, was unique historically. If you go back in history, what you find is that, first of all, every culture around the world had slavery. I mean, that's just simply a fact. But this was the first time that your population of slaves was drawn from a readily recognizable ethnic group. And, well, I mean, just as to give you an example, we talked about Slavs last night, the Slavic people of Central Europe. In every Western European language, the word for slave is connected to the word for Slav. And the reason is because in the early Middle Ages, Eastern Europe was overwhelmingly the source of slaves for Western Europe. But Slavs don't look that much different from other Europeans. You can't readily identify them. So what you see happening in early modern slavery, the African slave trade and such, is you have a group of people that's readily recognizable as being different. They got different skin color, they got different hair, all of these kinds of things. And that is the one source you've got for slaves. And further, slavery is increasingly coming under attack as an immoral institution, largely led, by the way, by Quakers and evangelicals. So how do you justify slavery? Well, what you do is you redefine race. You start using race to describe not just simply nationality or ethnicity or something like that, but you come up with a method to divide the world up, divide the humanity up into broad categories so that you have your Negroids from Africa, you have your Caucasians from Europe, you have your Mongoloids from Asia. And these are your three great people groups. If you want to, you can associate them with Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And thus, you now have three races, and then your next step is to pull in a little bit of Darwin and say that the Caucasian race, the European race, is more highly evolved than the others because they live in a harsh climate and therefore they have to get tougher. They have to get smarter. And thus, they are superior to the other races around the world, and thus, they have the right to dominate them. So now we have a justification for both slavery and imperialism. Anytime, and by the way, this also applies to critical race theorists, anytime you have someone who has race as a central part of their ideology, they are racist. Because race is always used to say this group is superior to that one, without exception. Now, they won't go there for themselves, but the critical race theorists are going to argue correctly that race is a social construct. It is invented, our concept of race is invented for purposes that have far more to do with society, how society is structured, how power is used in society, yeah, they're right about that, than it has anything to do with biology. So first pillar of critical race theory, it's true, race is a social construct. Second pillar, the definition of racism. The definition of racism keeps changing. When I was The old definition of racism is someone who thought that their race was superior to other races, looked down on other races, mistreated other races, used nasty words to describe other races, that kind of thing. That was what racism was when I was little. That definition changes by the, well, probably late 80s, early 90s, that definition changed. And it was changed because what they did is they added negative attitudes toward other races combined with power. Or as it was expressed to me, access to institutional power. Therefore, since whites have power and blacks do not, whites are the only people who can be racist by the new definition of racism. Because you have to have power to enforce your racist ideas, and therefore racism always includes power. Now, I want to point out right away that there's a fundamental problem here. And I'm going to use it in a different context, because this is not limited to critical race theory. It's also limited, it also extends to areas like sexism. When I was in grad school at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, the Berkeley of the Midwest, I was a teaching assistant. And as a result, I had to take a sexual harassment awareness training or something like that. I don't remember what it was called, political re-education. So I went to this session. Now, excuse me, let me back up a moment. I was a teaching assistant in a class that met in a very large classroom. It's actually European economic history. Okay. Before my class, there was a class that was taught by an endowed chair that is the top of the food chain in academia. And it was in, well, women's studies. And one day I walked into this classroom, and I'm a chronic reader. I'm sure that's a shock to you. But there were these brochures hanging around out there from the previous class. And I picked one of them up, and it was about pornography. And one of the main points was, pornography is a textbook teaching men how to treat women. I thought, yeah, right. And ignored it. Okay, jump back to my political re-education thing. I'm at this session, and they tell me that as a male, I have access to institutional power, so therefore I can harass females, but it doesn't really work the other way around. I thought, that's interesting. So during a break, I went up to the instructor and I said to him, okay, I am not putting in a complaint. I just want to understand this. You know, I told him the story about the leaflet, the handout. And I said, now, if I were ever to say something as stupid as Harlequin romances are a textbook teaching women how to relate to men, I could be brought up on charges of sexual harassment, right? He says, oh yeah, absolutely. I said, so what's the difference between the two? With a straight face, he said to me, you have access to institutional power. I want you to think about the fact that I am a grad student TA, and I have access to institutional power where an endowed chair at the university doesn't. If she had wanted to, she had it in her power to squash me like a bug, academically. Which of us had access to institutional power, really? But by the ideology, it's me, not her. The same thing applies with that newer definition of racism. It doesn't make sense because of the way they categorize it purely in terms of intersectional rules and this oppressor-oppressed dichotomy they've set up. The newest definition of racism, which you get in things like white fragility, is if you're white, you're racist. Done. You can't escape it. And we've already talked a little bit about that before. So we've got these changing definitions of racism that you need to work with. Lastly, there's the cultural hegemony. That is to say, again from yesterday vocabulary, the cultural worldview, the who dominates the culture. The assumption is that white supremacy and white privilege are the facts of life in American culture. And that's all that there is to it. Blacks are always on the short end of the stick. Now, white supremacy culture. You've got the website reference here. This is not something I made up. I'm not going to go through the whole list here, but I would like to point out a couple of key points. Actually, I'll just leave it to one this time. I'd like you to look at the second to the last of these points. Belief in objectivity. If you believe that there is objective truth, objective reality, anything like that, if you believe that something is objective at all, that's an example of white supremacy culture. I want you to think about that. Now, there are a whole lot of other things in the list here that we could go over, but for the sake of time, I will just limit it to pointing out that one. But it goes beyond this, because you've got the pyramid of white supremacy here. The bottom are the more socially acceptable kinds of white supremacy. The further up you go, the more overt they get until you get to a point where they're socially unacceptable. Now, I'm not going to go through all of this one either for obvious reasons, but there are a few that are worth noting. So, for example, if you argue that American culture should be an English-speaking culture, we need something to unite the country linguistically, that's white supremacy. If you argue that we should teach our own history, and including the roots to American society that are found in Europe, that's a Eurocentric curriculum, that is white supremacy. If you question the entire thing, if you say, you know, the question that was raised last night, if you guys follow through on your program, then suddenly I'm going to be the victim, you guys are going to be the oppressors, that's, even making that argument is white supremacy. If you'll notice on the right, left-hand side, the one, two, three, about the fourth up from the bottom, expecting people of color to teach white people, that's white supremacy. In other words, if I go to a black person and say to him, you know, I really don't understand the black experience. I'd like to understand it better. Will you tell me about it? I'm exerting white supremacy over that person. I have a friend who lives in a very, very white, affluent suburb right next to mine, West Hartford, Connecticut. For those of you who follow the pugcast, that's where the corner pug is. But anyway, when this whole Black Lives Matter thing came out, they had a sweeping set of, everybody in their neighborhood put up Black Lives Matter signs. And my friend wasn't really sure about this. Her mailman happened to be black. And so she was talking to him about it. And he said to her, well, you know, if I know everybody in the neighborhood, if they would be interested in hearing about my experience and, you know, just sort of getting a different perspective on things, I'd be happy to talk to them. So she said, great, this sounds like a wonderful idea. She went to her white neighbors and told them, hey, you know, the mailman, you know, so-and-so, volunteered to talk to us about the black experience. And every one of her neighbors were horrified. They accused her of being a racist because she dared to ask this guy about his experience. That's white supremacy culture, expecting people of color to educate you. That, by the way, is a major hint for you about one of the challenges you're going to face if ever you try to deal with this, if ever you try to address these issues. Now, we need to address them, that's the next talk. But you need to be aware that there are landmines here that you're not even going to be aware of because, frankly, they make no sense. How are you supposed to learn about this if you're not talking to somebody from the culture? Now, there are ways around this. And again, we'll talk more about that later. Now, objectivity and white supremacy. This is another one of these things that's important to understand. Remember, in critical theory coming out of postmodernism, truth is never objective. Truth is always subjective, and frankly, it's personal. With that, this ties in with what we said about standpoint theory and so on. All knowledge, from Foucault, all knowledge is really a tool of the hegemony. That is to say, the dominant culture dictates what qualifies as knowledge. Now, in response to that, critical theory argues that experience is, your personal experience is, as a member of an oppressed group particularly, is a criterion for truth. You can, your own personal experience, which again, from yesterday, it's self-validating and self-interpreting, this is just as valid an approach for truth as anything the hegemony has to offer you. What matters then, what emerges from this, is what I just simply refer to as the narrative. The narrative is the story of oppression that exists. So the narrative is what emerges in critical theory from looking at the experience of people in oppressed groups. If you argue against the narrative by using things like facts and statistics, you are being a white supremacist. Thus, the narrative is that it is open season by white cops on black males. If you point out the very small number of these shootings that actually take place, the very small percentage of those that have any question involved in them, you know, for example, the guy was armed and shooting at them. If you compare it to the statistics that you're actually, a black person is more likely to be shot by a black cop than a white cop, if you point out the fact that in terms of percentages, a black male is more likely to be killed by another black male than by a white police officer, all of those things are statistics that you can validate any number of different ways. None of that matters. If you bring those things up, you're being white. You're exerting white supremacy. Objectivity, facts, statistics don't matter. The narrative is more true because truth is subjective and personal. What this means then is there is no possibility in critical theory for shared truth. We all come from different experiences, different cultures, different intersectional identities, and therefore we all have our own truths. There's no possibility really of stepping out of your own experience. You can't do it. We're back to Vodi Bakum's term, ethnic Gnosticism. Now, keep in mind that not everybody who is influenced by critical theory will buy into all of this. But this is nonetheless, you know, very seriously in play with the people who really get what it's about and who have bought into it. Then you get white privilege. White privilege is a step down from white supremacy, but it is still a fact of life according to critical theory. And again, I'm not going to go through all of these. But there are one or two that are worth noting. So for example, in the second column, second one down on the right, believing you worked hard for and earned everything you have without receiving any help or advantage. So if you actually believe that you earned your place in society by virtue of your hard work, number one, well, frankly, you're wrong. You are taking too much of a personalized view of things. You are simply a product of your intersectional identity. But number two, the system is rigged, if you're white, the system is rigged in your favor. This is why Asian students in California are now being reclassified as white. Okay, so that would be an example of white privilege. Now, where this goes, then, is to Black Lives Matter, the Black Lives Matter movement. And what I like about, the best summary of Black Lives Matter that I've run into is from an African-American pastor, Christopher Brooks, from Detroit. And Chris Brooks said that Black Lives Matter is a legitimate slogan, but it's really problematic as a movement. And I think that this is accurate. And you can see why if you actually look at what, well, you can't find it anymore. It used to be, and I actually did this myself in the early days of Black Lives Matter. If you go to their website in the old days, they had a statement of what they believed and so on, what their cause stood for. This started getting publicized when Black Lives Matter became much more public, much more in the public's eye. This started getting publicized by conservative media saying, do you really understand what these people stand for? And they immediately scrubbed it from their website. So they're hiding what they're really about. The founders, both are lesbians, black lesbians, who describe themselves as trained Marxists. And what they really are cultural Marxists. So what you saw, if you went back to the early days when they were actually honest about what they stood for, you find it's really deeply rooted in critical theory and intersectionality, which means that they want solidarity with all the oppressed. So, for example, they rejected the patriarchal nuclear family. They argued that children should be raised by the community to the degree that mothers and children were comfortable with this. So we're looking at the breakdown of the nuclear family. Actually, they talk about the dismantling of the nuclear family. But you will notice a couple of things here. Children are raised by the community. The family isn't that's as significant. But number two, who's missing? To the degree that the children and the mothers are comfortable. The fathers. They completely ignore the role of men here. And throughout this, you will find really no reference to men being of any significance whatsoever. Because men are part of the patriarchy, and the patriarchy is oppressors. They have strong support for LGBTQ+. So for example, they did a rally for Black Trans Lives Matter in New York. They are stridently pro-abortion, despite the fact that more African-American babies are aborted than are born. Early on, they were making a number of anti-Semitic statements as well. The hidden assumption in Black Lives Matter, and frankly across critical theory, and this is again an important thing for you to get, is the assumption is that every possible culture, every possible family structure, every possible anything in a fair and equitable world would have equal results. People are infinitely malleable. We can be changed in any sorts of ways. And in the absence of oppression, the results end up being the same every time. Thus, anytime there is unequal outcomes in anything, like family structure or anything else, anytime there are unequal outcomes, it is the result of oppression. Thus, to put it in simple terms, children, if you look at the statistics globally, the best outcome from children statistically is if they live with their biological parents who are married. That's true across the board globally. The Black Lives Matter movement assumes that single-parent households should have exactly the same assumptions, or children raised by the village should have exactly the same results. Therefore, since they don't, that must be because the deck is stacked against them and they're being oppressed. It has nothing to do with reality. The other question that needs to be asked about to Black Lives Matter, it seems to me, is the question of which Black Lives Matter. Do unborn Black Lives Matter? Do Black police lives matter? Do Black victims of crime matter? Do owners of looted or burned businesses in the riots accompanying BLM who are Black, do those lives matter? Or are the only Black lives that matter those that support the narrative? To ask the question is to answer it. Now, the other, how am I doing for time?
It's almost an hour.
Oh, boy. Okay. I think we're going to have to hold off on the sexual revolution a bit. I'll try to start off with this and move to the other one because it's important to understand some elements of this as well. But we are about at break time, I've just been told. So, pardon me?
I want to ask you to speak about something before we break.
Sure.
I'm a believer that Christian resistance is going to be in our future. I'm also a believer that most Christians don't understand resistance. I was disappointed to see that some of your books are not purchased yet. Would you please tell us, seriously, most Christians have no idea. Would you tell us what the book is about and why you wrote it?
Okay, this is my latest book. It's called Slaying Leviathan. And again, the title comes from Leviathan, a book by Thomas Hobbes that was a defense essentially of totalitarianism in the form of absolute monarchy. Throughout history, Christians have always pushed back against governmental overreach. This may come as a bit of a surprise, but it has been the historic tradition of the church, starting with the first centuries. And over time, there were a number of different ideas developed about, for example, liberty of conscience, about human rights, about the proper limits of government, about fundamental distrust of government. All of these things emerged out of the Christian tradition. And then with the Reformation, the question came up, when does a legitimate king turn into an illegitimate tyrant? At what point can we begin resisting an unjust government? And there were very long and sophisticated and complex arguments about these. I'm sort of, in this book, I'm giving you kind of the thumbnail sketch bottom line on how these different ideas developed, ultimately culminating in the American Revolution. In a lot of ways, the American Revolution, even though it was already starting to move in a bit of a secular direction, the American Revolution and the Constitution are, in many ways, the culmination of a long history of Christian political theology. And the next big event that happens is the French Revolution. With the French Revolution, you have a completely secularized revolution, which is why it was far nastier and far more bloody and resulted in, well, literally over 100,000 people in France being killed during the course of the revolution. That purely secular notion of revolution has since dominated political thinking. All political thinking these days really goes to the French Revolution. There's a much earlier, much deeper, richer, and stronger tradition that came up within the church. And I think particularly in a situation where ideas like we see in critical theory are becoming increasingly common, it's important for us to start recovering many of those ideas and understanding where and when it's appropriate to draw the line and how to draw it.
So. If you are bothered by the power of the government today and you're concerned about what we should do about it, the theology that Glenn has mentioned, has basically been lost in evangelical Christianity today. Mm-hmm. You need to read this book. Get serious. And we'll get more of it. If you can help us pay for this event, please write us a check. We're going to start 10 minutes without you, so.